Well, greetings, brethren. Welcome once again to another Sabbath Bible study. It's good to be able to be back into the routine, I guess you could say, for lack of a better word, of being able to make tapes on a more regular basis than I have in the past. Very pleased to pass along to you that I am feeling a bit stronger. Still haven't put on a lot of weight, but I'm eating a little bit better and certainly feeling some better. I still have some problems and some discomfort after eating at times, sometimes even still quite severe, but many things have improved, and I'm very happy to be able to let you know that, and certainly once again to thank you for the many prayers and the much concern that has been evidenced on my behalf, and I greatly appreciate it and acknowledge my debt to you and obligation to you, something that I could never repay, not that we are to repay each other for our kindnesses, we are not, because we cannot repay the kindness that was done to us by the Father in heaven and by His Son, neither are we to repay each other's kindnesses as though they were debts that we had to cancel out on the ledger. But I want you to know that I very greatly recognize it and very greatly appreciate all of the effort and all of the concern of God's people for my health during this long siege of illness that still continues to some extent, but as I say, has definitely shown some improvement, for which I am very thankful to God and attribute all of any healing or change in my life to Him without question. I do want to also mention that the newest issue of Cornerstone magazine is basically complete. All of the articles have been submitted, and it will be just a matter of a few days before they will be going to press, and hopefully will be in your hands relatively soon, within the next few weeks. And I do hope that you will enjoy and profit from that effort that we make there. This particular tape is going to be probably titled the seventh in a series so far entitled The Specter of Globalism. A number of you have those tapes. If you do not have the preceding six tapes and are interested in this particular subject, I urge you to let us know. Write us a letter or whatever, email us. You have the email address that's on the letter that you receive with your tape every week, and that is certainly the easiest way if you are online, have a computer and a modem, and are online at all. You can simply email us at atir@aol903@aol.com. Just read it off of the letter that you get, and that's the simplest and easiest and quickest and most direct way of requesting any material from us. Then, of course, you can write or call. It is much more difficult to get through to me personally on a telephone call, but we do have someone who will answer or an answering machine that will pick up any requests that you might have. But you might want to get the preceding six tapes in this series entitled, once again, The Specter of Globalism. They were essentially made, I believe, all of them in probably 1995. I can't remember the exact date of the last one that I made, but it has been a while. There was a reason and purpose for my not continuing that series until now, and part of that reason, I won't go into all of it, but part of that reason certainly revolves around the fact that there are many other issues other than a discussion of world news and behind-the-scene events and things of that nature that these tapes go into that I feel like that this ministry needs to be concerned with. And so in order to achieve that kind of balance and to have the kind of material available that I feel confident is helpful to God's people in their spiritual lives and in their personal walk with God and in their relationship with the Messiah, then I felt that we needed to take a break from that type of that series and the information that it was conveying, in spite of the fact that I believe it conveyed truth. There's no question about that. But all truth is not equal. And there are deeper truths that need to be more fully expounded, and that is what we attempt to do on a week-by-week basis in these tapes and in the articles that are written for the Cornerstone magazine. We don't always achieve that purpose perfectly. I doubt very seriously if that is true, but our effort is certainly in that direction, and certainly our prayers are that God would bless with effectiveness such outreach efforts And to the greatest extent, I think they certainly have been so blessed because the feedback has been so overwhelmingly positive. And people are not commending me for saying things that they wanted to hear. They are saying, you are telling us things we need to hear, because basically what I preach is not an easy message. It is a message of a one-on-one walk with God that requires us to get on our knees and seek Him with all of our hearts, and it requires us to give up everything for Him and yield everything up to Him so that we can become new creatures, indeed creatures, as I said on the last tape, creatures that never existed before, a race of beings that has never existed before. We are to become brand new creatures filled with the indestructible heredity of the Creator of the universe. We're talking about something that is so unique, so rare, a transformation so great that there are not words in my vocabulary adequate enough to express it. I call upon God's people to make hard choices, and beyond hard choices, hard roads to travel, because we are not called here to find a comfort zone in our spiritual lives and wrap ourselves up in security blankets of men. I speak against that, no matter what stripe they may be. And I urge and plead and pray for and speak to God's people, hopefully at least, a message that is of hope and that is of courage and that speaks to change and willingness to yield into the potter's hands, no matter how tough it may be or how much it may hurt or what it may require us to give up or what it may require us to face or how abruptly it may break us out of our conventions and our house of cards, our assumptions, the things that we take for granted. The call upon our lives, brethren, is so great, so ominous, so heavy, that it absolutely requires that we break free from the ways of men and the ways of human nature, the conventions of men, the institutions of men, the laws of men, the traditions of men. We must seek what is in the Scriptures. We must desire to be like God, and we must throw ourselves upon Him at His feet, seeking Him with all of our hearts, asking Him to break down every single solitary barrier that inhibits or prohibits the power of the Holy Spirit flowing through us and the reality of the living Messiah taking up residence within us and truly manifesting Himself through us. That doesn't mean belonging to some church organization for X number of years or being able to quote a scripture here and there. It doesn't mean being content and happy. It means never being content where you are in the spiritual sense, though where we are physically we may indeed have to be content, as much of what we learn in this physical, in this spiritual life has to do with difficulty in the physical. Therefore, I do not decry trials, I rejoice in them, and I urge you to do the same. This calling is too important for it to be achieved in any human life through ease, through complacency, through taking for granted that which has been given and that and the one who gave it. We can never afford that. When we do, we stagnate. When we do, we stifle the Spirit, the flow of the Spirit, and we actually stay the outstretched arm of our God to intervene and to work with us and to save us. His arm is not shortened, but we can shorten it. That is to say, we can prevent it by erecting the barriers and the shields in our lives that make us feel comfortable and cozy, and that everything is right in the world. But in reality, the price we pay for that kind of security and comfort and coziness is that we give up the opportunity for God to put His hands directly on us. We give up the chance to confront Him on His terms and allow Him to use us as He sees fit. And I tell you, brethren, until we catch a vision of what God is doing, where He's leading us, what this calling is all about, we simply will always gravitate toward the comfort and the security in our spiritual lives that men can give us. And that has to be where the break occurs. That is where the chains must come off. And that has been the heart of this ministry since its inception and continues to be. I've been criticized for being too hard on organizations and on leaders. And I personally do not think that I have been. But if I have been unfair and unjust in criticism, I do apologize. But I do not apologize for speaking the truth and for standing up to it and for at least using what God has given me to sound a warning and to give some hope and hopefully some direction to the people who are able to hear and who have ears to hear. I am nothing more than a conduit, a servant. And that is my hope and my goal for all of us. If we all can be called good servants, if we all can be termed by the Father in heaven as good servants, then we have gone beyond the call of duty, because a servant can look at himself, if he has only done what is required of him, and say that he is an unworthy servant. That is what our Savior taught us. Well, I didn't intend to talk about that, but I got kind of carried away. So I want to get into this subject today, and I believe we'll just go ahead and entitle it The Specter of Globalism, Part 7. And what I'm going to talk about is going to be prefaced by my reading Daniel, the 9th chapter. If you would like to turn there, I'm going to begin reading in verse 25, Daniel 9:25. This is very familiar to all of us. "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem, unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks, and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous times. And after the 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood. And unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he," that is to say this Prince that shall come, "will confirm a covenant with many," or the covenant with many, "for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate." This is from the King James Version. It's a very familiar passage of Scripture concerning the so-called 70 weeks prophecy given to the prophet Daniel. I don't want to go in and give a version of what this might mean as far as history is concerned, but I will mention the fact, or the point at least, that this prophecy is generally understood, and I think rightly so, as having an end-time application. This last or 70th week, and we all understand this to be a week of years, or 70 weeks of years, a 490-year period, 7 times 70, that the last of these weeks, the 70th week, or last 7 years, indeed is, or comprises, the last 7 years prior to the return of the Messiah to this earth, as described, for instance, in the book of Zechariah, chapter 14, when it says, "In that day his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives, and it shall cleave in half, and that he will come with 10,000s of his saints," as Jude recorded Enoch as saying in the book of Jude, as you are all familiar, I'm quite sure. That this 70th week, these last 7 years, are very significant, and quite frankly, signs of the times may tell us that they are very, very near. It is very possible to come to a conclusion based upon biblical chronology and certain prophecies in the Bible that we are perhaps entering into the last 7 years. There are all kinds of speculations, of course, and I don't really want to add my speculations to that. I have done some speculating, and it is just that, because I do not believe anyone at this point that I know of on earth has a true revelation from God precisely when the return of the Messiah is going to occur. Now, there are some who think they know. I realize that. And they have set dates. Most of those dates have come and gone and have been, of course, obviously unsuccessful. Unfortunately, most of those who predicted those dates do not repent, do not tell the people they were wrong, or that they were misled, deceived, or that they were false prophets. They just engineer new dates, or they gloss over their errors and continue on trying to maintain their following. That is a sad state of affairs that these would-be prophets are in, and indeed the people are in themselves, because so many swallow it all and allow it to continue rather than seeing red flags and real signs on the horizon of something wrong being afoot. But be that as it may, those of us who have come out and who are beginning to see the light more clearly need to have a balanced and right view of the end time, whenever that may happen. Now, there are many signs in this world. If you go back over the course of a given year, say of 1997, there are, and you begin to analyze the things that happen. As they happen, we don't always feel or see the impact. But if you review a particular year and you have access to the information and the news and the things that can be evaluated, you will see that remarkable things are occurring in this world. Some of them are evident, some of them are not as evident, but can be discovered, can be mined out, as it were, and evaluated and examined and assayed. And I tell you, the more you do that, the more convinced you will become and convicted you will become that the time for the return of Christ is undoubtedly drawing near. Well, this speaks of that general time period, these last 7 years in Daniel, the 9th chapter. It is a very pivotal prophecy in the Bible. Of course, it talks about the Messiah's first coming, we realize that, and the fact that he would be cut off. But there is a prince that shall come that is mentioned here also in verse 26. And it is this prince that shall come that I want to focus upon today. Now, what I'm going to cover may be controversial. I don't know if I hope it is or isn't. I don't really care. Either way, all I'm interested in is sharing some facts with you that you may not be fully aware of. Some of you may be. Some of you may be way ahead of me in this endeavor. But be that as it may, I'm going to simply cover the subject in the time period that I have left as best I can. And it concerns a prince. I am not saying that the prince about whom I will speak on this tape and in this message is the prince that shall come. But I am offering to you evidence that ought to be considered as we look at a very likely scenario of the end time based upon Scripture and based upon unfolding historical or unfolding events, current events, as well as things that are potentially going to transpire either behind the scenes or overtly. Many of you, if you've studied much about recent history, will be familiar with the name Cecil Rhodes. Cecil Rhodes lent his name to the Rhodes Scholarship. Now, most of us are familiar with Rhodes Scholars. Every year, a certain number of college graduates, I believe they would be graduates. I don't know all the details of this, so please forgive me if I misstate something along this line. But each year, a certain number of Rhodes Scholarships are awarded to graduating students from college, giving them the opportunity to travel to England and study. The Rhodes Scholarship Program was established by a man named Cecil Rhodes. He is the founder of the international diamond industry of Rhodesia and South Africa. He is a man who is was in his day one of the most influential and important men in the entire world. He was an operative of the British Crown, and he was in the employ of the Rothschilds banking cartel, which is, of course, still in existence today, and indeed was the very founder of the whole central banking system in Europe and in England, the Bank of England, as well as the power behind the throne, as it were, in the creation of the U.S. Central Bank, both at the beginning of this nation's history, back in the early 1800s, when the plan eventually was abandoned because of opposition, until the year 1909 and 1910, when a group of powerful financiers and entrepreneurs met off the coast of Georgia on one of Georgia's golden isles that some of you may actually have been in keeping perhaps one of the Feast of Tabernacles, and that is Jekyll Island, Georgia. Anybody who has kept a Feast of Tabernacles, and I know I'm speaking to a number who have in this message, so I'll just go ahead and say that. If that sounds strange to your ears, if you happen to be a person who is not used to keeping the feast or has never been in the particular traditions that I have or many of the listeners have, please forgive us. But anyone who has kept a festival at Jekyll Island or even visited Jekyll Island, Georgia, is probably aware of the meetings that took place there with people like Jay Gould and J.P. Morgan and John Rockefeller and some of the other great magnates of their time in the early years of this century in order to plan out what ultimately became America's permanent central banking system known as the Federal Reserve. If you want good, hard information on the Federal Reserve System and what it's really all about, you might read the book by Eustace Mullins entitled The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. There are many other books on that subject. I wish I had a list of them here. I didn't even plan to even mention the Federal Reserve System, really, but I'm just giving you a little bit of a background, which if you have the first six tapes on globalism or you have access to other information, you are well aware of this already. But I want to emphasize the importance that Cecil Rhodes, or Cecil perhaps, I'm not quite sure how he would have pronounced his name, but Cecil Rhodes, the important part that he played in the 1800s especially in creating a force in England that later became so influential in this country and indeed has affected things right down to this very day, and indeed, most especially, the individual that I want to talk about primarily on this tape, if I ever get around to it. Please forgive me for rambling. In the last of his seven wills, Cecil Rhodes set up the Rhodes Scholarship Program, while his former wills provided parameters for the trustees who were to bring the world back under British rule. And it was to be carried out through a secret society. In his will, he stipulated that the kind of person, he stipulated the kind of person who should be chosen for the Rhodes Scholarship. Now, if some of you want to do some interesting reading, you might read the two books written by Professor Carol Quigley, Q-U-I-G-L-E-Y, who was a top professor at the Georgetown University and was President Bill Clinton's mentor. Who, in fact, he was the one who chose Bill Clinton for his Rhodes Scholarship. He wrote two books that are considered epics in understanding the truth about modern history. The first one was Tragedy and Hope, and the second was The Anglo-American Establishment. Now, this man is no conspiracy theorist who's over in the woodwork popping his head out. This is one of the most respected men in his field in the world, and indeed an insider. He was privy to all sorts of insider knowledge and understanding of how the establishment in this world works, especially in England, Europe, and America. The second of these two books, The Anglo-American Experience, in that book, he wrote that the secret society that would be formed by the Rhodes will, the seven wills that Cecil Rhodes made out to dispense his fortune, in a way to dispense his fortune, in his second book he wrote that the secret society that would be formed by the Rhodes will, quote, and I'm going to quote out of the book, was to devote itself to the preservation and expansion of the British Empire, which had been known at various times as Milner's Kingdom, or Milner's Kindergarten, as the Round Table Group, as the Rhodes Crowd, as the Times Crowd, as the All Souls Group, and as the Cliveden Set, C-L-I-V-E-D-E-N. These are names that will not mean a lot to some of you. To some researchers, they will all ring bells. If you do much study and research into British history in the 1718s and early 1900s, you will run across these names. These names are cover names, in a manner of speaking, for a secret group that formed itself under the guidance of Cecil Rhodes and under the auspices of the Rothschild banking cartel and the royal families of Europe and the nobility of England especially, to conspire. Yes, I'm going to use the word conspire and conspiracy because it very certainly was that, to conspire together to use their money, their power, their influence with politicians, with diplomats, with corporate heads, with banking institutions, whatever the case may be, to influence and to transform the process from the democracy that we were, or the people of Western Europe and America were used to and believed in and championed, to a sort of regal nobility rulership, a monarchical rulership, really, if you want to term it by some name, in which the ones who control the purse strings and the power strings would control the people, and it would be primarily in the hands of a cartel based in London, England, that would eventually take back the United States of America under its wing. Now, you and I may ostensibly, on the surface, not be able to see how that plan and program has come to pass, but it actually has. It actually has. I'm going to continue to read here. Furthermore, Rhodes outlined men who might be useful members of the secret society, men of ability, he said, and enthusiasm, who find no suitable way to serve their country under the current political system. He said this is to be a kind of religious brotherhood like the Jesuits, a church for the extension of the British Empire. According to Quigley, and I am going to quote once again, so forgive me for making as many quotes as I am here, but I think I want to be authoritative in what I'm saying here. In looking to determine how to bring the world under British rule, here is what Dr. Carroll Quigley wrote. He says that according to the secret society founded by Cecil Rhodes and his compatriots, they caused the Boer War of 1899 through 1902. It set up the controls and controls the Rhodes Trust. It created the Union of South Africa in 1906 through 1910 and has been the most powerful single influence in the new colleges at Oxford for more than a generation. It has controlled the Times, that is to say the London Times, the most prestigious and powerful newspaper, certainly in England, probably throughout Europe, maybe in the world. That would be a judgment call if it could be considered the world's most powerful newspaper, but certainly one of them, and by all means the most important in England and the continent. It has controlled the Times for more than 50 years, with the exception of 3 years. It publicized the idea of and the name British Commonwealth of Nations in the period from 1908 to 1918. It was the chief influence in Prime Minister Lloyd George's war administration from 1917 through 1919 and dominated the British delegation to the peace conference of 1919. And this, of course, was the prelude to the attempt by the world community to form the League of Nations, which we will certainly just mention right here again. It had a great deal to do with the formation and management of the League of Nations and of the system of mandates. It founded the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the RIIA, as it is generally referred to. This is a very significant organization, far more so. And in fact, it has been through the RIIA that much of the legacy of Cecil Rhodes has been passed down and has been promulgated and brought to fruition in current times. It still controls the I of the RIIA, by the way. It was one of the chief influences on British policy toward Ireland, Palestine, and India in the period from 1917 to 1945. It was a very important influence on the policy of appeasement of Germany during the years from 1920 through 1940, and it controlled and still controls to a very considerable extent the sources and the writing of the history of British imperial and foreign policy since the Boer War at the turn of the century. Now, I'm through quoting. I'll end of quote there. So it should be noted here, I believe, brethren, that the American counterpart to the Royal Institute for International Affairs is the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, many of you are familiar with the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations. It was formed in about 1921 or 22 and has been the single most influential body within the United States affecting the political and social history of this country from that time until this day. That is not speculation. None of this is speculation that I have covered so far. Not at all. These are facts that can be easily documented and easily proven in any court of law or in any other forum as far as that goes. This is a known fact. You may not be aware of it, but that's simply because maybe you haven't delved into it or it hasn't come to your attention at this point in time. But it is coming to your attention now. And it is absolutely and totally correct. There is no way to deny it. The Royal Institute for International Affairs was the mother organization that spawned the Council on Foreign Relations in this country. They both are controlled from England ultimately, though the American counterpart is recognized as having a certain independent status and certainly is able to operate on its own in many respects. But we can never forget where its ties really are and where they go back to. The Council on Foreign Relations has been heavily influenced by the Rockefeller family in this country. I don't think that too much emphasis or stress can be placed on that fact. David Rockefeller has played the most dominant role. If we could single out one individual who has played a more dominant role in the promulgating the goals of the British Empire and British control and control of the financiers of this world, the money, the powered people of this world, more in this country, it would be David Rockefeller. He certainly was instrumental in the Council on Foreign Relations. He was, of course, the founder, along with Zbigniew Brzezinski and certain others, of the Trilateral Commission in the early 70s. And I think David Rockefeller is still alive. He's an old man now, but he has a long history of direct involvement with the continuation of a secret society that was actually established in the days of Cecil Rhodes and really took its origins from secret societies that had been extant in Europe for hundreds and hundreds of years. And brethren, when it all boils down to the final common denominator and the lowest common denominator, we will see that the secret goals of a few people to rule this world and to set up a one-world government and a one-world religion and to amalgamate mankind under it is the plan of Satan the devil. There is no question about it. It is incontestable. Satan the devil, from the Garden of Eden on, has been seeking to work out and formulate a way whereby he can draw all mankind to himself and thereby usurp the very throne of God, something that he has tried to do before unsuccessfully and now is attempting to achieve through taking the children of God, the creation of God on this planet Earth, and drawing them to himself one way or another, hopefully under the banner and umbrella of a one single world government, a world religion, a world social system that he will be able to fully influence, because it will all be interconnected and interrelated and will not be able to function without dependence and connection with one another. And when you establish that and get that perfectly interconnected all around this world, then even if one part feels that he wants to resist, he cannot break free, because his whole existence is tied together by the interdependence of the structure that Satan is creating in this world. He has been attempting to do it, and God has thwarted him all through history. He attempted to do it in the pre-flood world, and it precipitated the flood. The sins that were rampant upon the earth were to a great extent precisely the very sins of Satan and his demonic forces in an increasing frenzy during the time of the pre-flood world to gather that entire world unto himself. using instruments of destruction and of his own calling and persuasion to throughout the world to pervert mankind, using the line of Cain, if you will, because that very genealogy in the fourth chapter of the book of Genesis is there not to just let you know that Cain had a progeny. Of course we would know that anyway. The two lines are there in the book of Genesis. The line of Seth and the line of Cain in Genesis 4 and 5 are there because they are contrasts. They are a study in contrasts. One is being contrasted against the other or with the other. And a lot can be learned simply by musing on those two lines and realizing that one line was opposed to the other, and the dynasty created under the line of Cain became the dominant line in the pre-flood world. And they, through them, they became men of renown. And they were men who had demonic powers, men and women, I should say. And they became the gods and the goddesses of mythology. Interestingly enough, there are exactly 12 of them listed in the fourth chapter of the book of Genesis. Count them for yourself. You will find that, and I have said this before, that many of the ancient pantheons of gods in the various mythologies of Rome and Greece and of Babylon and of Egypt, etc., you will find that their top echelon generally has 12 gods and goddesses. Where did they come from? They did not just dream them up. They came from the mind of Satan the devil, and they are from the very beginning. The building of the Tower of Babel afterwards is easily seen as an effort to amalgamate all of mankind under a satanically inspired ruler, and God thwarted it then. And attempts have been made and secret societies formed from that time until this day for the express avowed purpose of pushing an agenda that will ultimately bring mankind under one rule, whether it be in religion, politics, social order, economic order, you name it. That is the goal of Satan the devil. And he is a conspirator. And I make no apology for using the word conspiracy, as many of these evangelists and preachers in the churches of God refuse to do, sticking their heads in the sand, knowing better in most cases, but refusing to face the consequences of breaking out of their conventional little mold in order to speak the truth for fear of being embarrassed or of losing support and favor of men, and also fear of confrontation. You see, most of them do not want to face confrontation. They do not want to face the unpleasantness of persecution. So they will not speak the truth in this matter. In fact, they will brand a person like myself, and I really don't do a lot of speaking on it. I've done some, but others have done much more. But they will brand a person who does that as a conspiracy nut. Well, I'll tell you this, brethren, I would rather be a fool for Christ than the most intelligent, well-ensconced evangelist in the world. And that's a fact. Let's move on. Now, where was I? I was talking about the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the fact that the Council on Foreign Relations in this country came from that. The Council on Foreign Relations has been subsidized by the Rockefeller, the Ford, the Mellon, and the Carnegie and the Kellogg foundations since its inception back in the early 20s. The Trilateral Commission was formed later as a network of European, American, and Japanese contributors at the highest level in order to plan economic policy throughout the world. It has actually become an extremely influential organization in establishing economic and social policies in all three areas, just as the Council on Foreign Relations has been almost the single, there's no question, the single most influential group in establishing American foreign policy since the end of World War I until this very day. In addition, there is interconnectedness, excuse me, with many of the multinational corporations with the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute for International Affairs. Many of the chief executive officers of corporations serve as directors on each or other's boards of directors. It is a kind of involved corporate nepotism that has been occurring for generations in this country and indeed on the world scene as well. This kind of close relationship also exists on the global level, where many corporations work with a number of international organizations, such as the International Chamber of Commerce and the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. You might want to remember that one, because I'm going to come back to it if I have time. The World Business Academy and the International Institute for Sustainable Development. Now, I'm going to talk about the individual that I was referring to earlier, this prince that shall come. I'm not saying that this man is the prince that shall come. As I said before in my preface, I'm simply going to discuss this man a little bit more in detail. I do want to read another quote from Mr. Quigley, Dr. Quigley, here in his book, The Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American Establishment. He says, the group, that is to say the group formed by Cecil Rhodes back in the 1800s that has been promoted and promulgated through the years of time up until today, this group feared the British Empire might fall into the same difficulty and destroy British idealism and British liberties by the tyranny necessary to hold on to a reluctant empire. And any effort to hold an empire by tyranny they regarded as doomed to failure. The group feared that all culture and civilization would go down to destruction because of our inability to construct some kind of political unit larger than the national state. Just as Greek culture and civilization in the 4th century B.C. went down to destruction because of the Greeks' inability to construct some kind of political unit larger than the city-state. This was the fear that had animated Cecil Rhodes, and it was the same fear that was driving the group to transform the British Empire into a commonwealth of nations and then place that system within a league of nations. End of quote. And the United Nations, brethren, became the successor to the League of Nations in 1945. Interestingly enough, the man that I'm going to talk about was born not right on the day of the year of the League of Nations, but just shortly thereafter. His name is Charles Prince Arthur George Mountbatten Windsor. Does the name sound familiar to you? Well, we know him simply as Prince Charles. Prince Charles of England is the man I want to talk about in the remaining part of this tape. He was born in a very significant year, 1948. It was the year that the United Nations created a separate state for Israel. And 1998 will mark the jubilee, or the 50th year from that declaration that was made by the United Nations in 1948. So obviously Prince Charles will also be 50 in this year. I do not know the date of his birth. I don't have it here with me. But it is very interesting. In 1969, his mother made him the Prince of Wales in the ceremony at Caernarfon Castle in Wales. His investiture marked the start of his royal duties, and he became a Knight of the Garter. Now, it's members of the Order of the Garter that comprise the Queen's inner circle of confidants. According to his biographer, that is Charles' biographer, Anthony Holden, and I quote, at the same moment Prince Charles was being invested as the Prince of Wales, across the world three men were preparing to land on the moon. I remember that particular time. I imagine that you do too. I remember watching Prince Charles' investiture in the summer of 1969. It was a lovely affair, a magnificent affair, as all of the English coronations and investitures are. As the 21st Prince of Wales, his titles, Charles' titles, include, of course, the future title of King of England, Charles III, he would be. He is indeed the 21st Prince of Wales. He is the Earl of Chester, the Duke of Cornwall, the Duke of Rothesay. He is the Earl of Carrick. He is Baron Renfrew. He is Lord of the Isles and Great Steward of Scotland. He is Knight of the Most Noble Order of the Garter. He is Knight of the Most Ancient and Most Principal Knight, Grand Cross of the Most Honorable Order of the Bath. And he is the Knight of the Most Ancient and Most Noble Order of the Thistle. It is the Order of the Bath, by the way, into which both ex-Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Bush were inducted and knighted after they left office. Prince Charles, brethren, has an unusual lineage. He is literally related to everyone of royal blood in the world, virtually everyone, along with a few who are not, such as Charles Darwin. According to the English geologist Gerald Paget, who spent most of his 92 years tracing the lineage of Queen Elizabeth and Prince Charles, he says in his book The Lineage and Ancestry of His Royal Highness Prince Charles, Prince of Wales, the following, and I quote, "His Royal Highness Prince Charles' breeding is the most important in the world. He is heir to the world's greatest position that is determined solely by heredity." He says that His Royal Highness is cousin or nephew, in varying degrees, of all the six wives of Henry VIII. He has many descents from the royal houses of Scotland, France, Germany, Austria, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, Spain, Portugal, Russia, and the Netherlands. In addition to Charlemagne and William the Conqueror, he numbers amongst his ancestors such historic characters as King Alfred the Great, King Harold, who was slain at Hastings, Llewellyn, the great prince of North Wales, Owain Glyndwr, the Warwick, the King Master, or Kingmaker, Margaret, Countess of Salisbury, who was the last of the Plantagenet, House of Plantagenets, the Protector, Edward Seymour, the Duke of Somerset, and his rival, John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland, Louis the Ninth, King of France, the Emperor Rudolf of Habsburg, Catherine the First, Empress of Russia, Robert de Bruce, and Mary, Queen of Scots, to name a few. He said,